on this episode of Skeptico.
The theory of Caesar's Messiah, because it's just simply based on the sequence of these passages in these two books. I mean, how much trouble is it for me to defend it? I just say, let's just put the text out side by side. You know, I told one scholar, I said, how old is your son? He goes, he's like 18. I said, okay, just read it to your son side by side and have him tell you if there is enough parallelism. Anyone can see it. It's obvious. And if there's one thing that comes out of Caesar's Messiah that I hope occurs, is just that it will not only end the ability of the politicians to use Christianity as a propaganda tool, but eventually it will force people to then put some sunlight into the Hebrew Bible and say, wait a second, you know, what we're looking at tip to stern from Genesis all the way through the book of Revelation is the literature of oligarchs. These stories are there to fool people into giving power to people that want to rule.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I'm going to return to the topic of Christianity. And as I mentioned in the last episode, this is a show I've been looking forward to doing for a while. Skeptico is about big picture science questions. Who are we? Why are we here? And I always say science questions, but they're really life questions. The biggest questions about how we should live our life, what we should do, boil down to those questions. Who are we? Why are we here? Now, a good part of this show, as you know, is about countering the assumption that we all live under as Westerners in a scientific world, and that is the assumption that we are essentially biological robots in a meaningless universe. That is, we are these purely physical beings, and everything about our minute-by-minute experience is driven by our brains and our biology. Now, the reason I'm going over that ground, which I go over all the time, is to, I guess, take a step back today and say, if we're really going to be fair, we have to acknowledge that scientific dogma is in a large part a reaction to the other dominant cultural force we live with, and that is the religious dogma that answers those who are we, why are we here questions with a very definitive, well, right here it is, buddy, here's the Bible. It's all there. And whether that's said directly or whether we politically correctly massage it into something less, this is our cultural heritage. It's woven throughout our legal system, our social system, our values, our political system. It's everywhere. So as a result, the question of Christianity and its validity is something that I've returned to many times on this show. And the one touchstone that I always return to because I think his work is so pivotal in understanding Christianity, and in particular this issue of the Bible and its origins and its validity, is the work of Joe Atwell, author of Caesar's Messiah, among other books. And I interviewed Joe over a year ago, and it's one of those interviews that keeps popping up in that I will get comments, I will get questions, I will get attacks about the interview and the position that I've taken, because Joe has become somewhat of a lightning rod controversial figure in this field of New Testament scholarship, which is a whole rat's nest in and of itself. You could spend your life in critical analysis of biblical scholarship and the Christians on one side and the atheists on the other and all that stuff. So what I always appreciated about Joe, besides his fierce independence, is his ability to really cut through a lot of that and succinctly focus in on the key issues. So in this interview with Joe, I covered a lot of ground. In fact, I covered so much ground that we talked for almost 3 hours, and I didn't feel like I could really deliver all that in a podcast, although I will make that available to you if anyone wants to listen to the whole thing. I'll have it there, downloaded. I think there's a lot of great stuff in there that I wound up cutting out to fit into basically an hour format of this show. But in the process of presenting this, you will hear me jump in to clarify where we're going, what topic we're covering, and provide a little background as well, because I think some of this stuff can get pretty esoteric. It's really not that hard to understand if you have a little bit of background. And for most of us, I think the material is at least somewhat familiar. But if you don't remember exactly who Constantine is or who Josephus was, I'll try and provide a very quick sketch in order to make some of this material accessible. So with that, let's jump right into this interview. This first clip, I don't think really needs that kind of introduction. It's a topic that I've covered many times on this show, but I think it's absolutely central to Atwell's theory, and I think this is so misunderstood, and that's the issue of conspiracy. On one level, this shouldn't be controversial at all. We all know it's historically established and well understood that governments, kings, the ruling class use religion to control people. And it's certainly documented in the Roman Catholic Church. So the only question would be, how far back does it go? So it always surprises me when people are so outraged and just shocked that Atwell should suggest that these kind of shenanigans were going on in the first century AD. Of course they were. The Romans were all over this kind of stuff. Now, that doesn't mean Atwell is correct, but let's hear what he has to say about the issue of how a conspiratorial lens might provide a different view of early Christian history. What I think is so fascinating and intriguing about your work, as I mentioned in a couple of posts, is not necessarily a literal, are you on board with everything that Atwell says in his theories, but where does this new way of looking at things take us, and how does it fit within these other pieces that we try and pull together? And there's two parts of that that I think are particularly interesting, and we already touched on one, which is the conspiratorial angle. And it just amazes me how that can almost divide the world. When I see people confront your theories and your book, Caesar's Messiah, and their first reaction is, oh, conspiracy theory. I, therefore, according to my programming, must immediately ignore all of that. That is outside the realm of possibility. To me, the exact opposite is the case, in that when I look at anything in the world, any major event, my first thought is, okay, what's the conspiratorial angle? You know, I mean, Osama bin Laden is supposedly killed and his body is dumped in the ocean because it's okay. Right. That sounds like bullshit. Let me start looking for the conspiracy. Maybe it's true, maybe it isn't. But my starting point is that the forces and powers that control money and power, their lifeblood is conspiracies. So I just see that as dividing line number one is, do you have a conspiratorial worldview or not? And maybe before I go on too much, why don't you, I don't really know. I mean, what is your general feeling about conspiracy and how it affects our world?
It's all a conspiracy. 9-1-1, World War I, World War II. The most obvious conspiracy that we've suffered from was Constantine using Christianity as the foundation of the feudal system. I mean, this was clearly an insincere, conspiratorial, secret society, you know, moment where he developed the feudal system with a series of edicts, and then also threw in the Edict of Milan to start the process of making Christianity the state religion so that the slave would think that there was a religious context for his condition.
Okay, let me jump in with a couple of quick points about Constantine in case you've forgotten. Constantine, Roman Emperor, around 300 AD, also known as Constantine the Great, also known as Saint Constantine, because he is the first person to establish the Christian church, to make it legal in the Roman Empire, and then really to usher it in as the official religion of the Roman Empire. And there's this famous saying that you'll hear Christians talk about a lot, where Constantine is preparing for battle, and he looks up and he sees
a cross in the sky by the sun, and he tells his troops that this is a sign and that they should paint that cross onto their shields and they'll be victorious in battle. And they are victorious in battle, and hence he takes it as a sign that he should adopt this religion. Okay, great. And then he goes on and builds these churches, and the Christians really extol this guy as such a great figure in history who did all these wonderful things. But if you dig into the history of this guy, it's fascinating. Joe's going to tell you a little bit of his history and why he already tells you a little bit about how cynical he thinks he is and how his play was really to consolidate power, just like every other Roman emperor, and how absolutely disastrous his policies were for ordinary people. But the other thing about his history I think is fascinating is here's a guy who kills his son because he thinks his son is having an affair with his second wife. So he kills his son. Then he finds out that, oh, there wasn't really an affair. So he kills his wife. This is not your model Christian, folks. But of course, all that's just whitewashed in the great rush to celebrate the Christian faith. That is the history of Constantine. But it's also a complex history. And this is a point that I differ with Joe on, in that much later in life, as he's preparing to die, he does seem to get much more pious and saintly. So now I'm tipping too much of my hand. Let's get back to Joe's comments. But I wanted to give you that little background on Constantine so you can fit it into the story. What I think is important about your work, and I keep thinking that folks aren't looking at it in quite the same way, is that's known, but that little piece isn't pulled together in the way that you're pulling it together to make the case and draw us to looking at the broader conspiracy that might be involved here. And that's what I think is important about Constantine. You know, but a couple other things about Constantine, let me jump over on the other side of the fence, because sometimes I do feel like where we probably differ is I think that my read of the situation is that the supernatural, the spiritual, the paranormal is at play. And we have to determine the reality of that. And I think the best way of determining the reality of that is to look at the current reality of it. But if that sounds a little bit strange for a second, let me put that on hold and say, you know, in I think the year is 313 or 314, Constantine is standing on the edges of Rome and is about to go in. And the current emperor of Rome is this kid who's usurped the throne from the real emperor. He's there, and correct me if I get any of this history wrong, but he's there contemplating whether he should go out and fight Constantine or whether he should stay hunkered down. And he's making this decision by having his advisor read the entrails of a goat and refer to this, you know, book of prophecy that they're reading. This is supernaturally infused leadership. And I don't think the story of Constantine is fabricated either, that he's there and he looks up and he sees something in the sky and he says, hey, that's a symbol, draw it on all our swords. And I think these people were living in a supernatural world where the world that most of the world's population lives in, where they believe that there is this extended force, this extended consciousness that does influence our lives. So I don't know where you stand on that, if you see Constantine as purely a cynical, spiritual kind of person, or this complex kind of mixed together of crazy kind of barbaric to, in our mind, just ridiculous psychopathic kind of stuff that he does mixed in with this kind of trying to access some divinity, or whether you see that as purely a cynical play on his part. What do you think about that?
I think it's purely a cynical play. I don't think that the oligarchs are in general sincere about the religious visions that they perceive. I think that the patrician class, I mean, just as an example, Vespasian's comment when he's about to die, supposedly, is that, you know, oh my, I must be becoming a god. I think most people who've read it recognize that this is, you know, something, someone who is very cynical about religion is saying. So It's a difficult question, though, because, you know, you don't know how far to generalize it. I think some of them are very cynical. However, others could well have been sincere. I mean, was Nero or Caligula sincere in their belief about their divinity? Possibly. But how would you determine it? I don't know. I operate just in terms of, you know, my analysis from the perspective that the patrician class are cynics.
Okay, next, Joe and I talk about the second major factor, I think, that divides people in understanding this history, this early Christian history, and in particular, understanding Atwell's theory, and that is our relationship to the supernatural. This is what divides Christians from atheists in a way that is on one hand obvious and on another hand is extremely subtle and under the surface. That is, do you believe that there's this extended consciousness that people access and get information from or get guidance from or at the very least yearn to connect to? So I've cut out a considerable amount of time that I spent with Joe in talking about near-death experience science, meditation science, and all the science out there that falsifies the atheistic, scientific, reductionistic mind equals brain model that I talk so much about. He was unaware of some of it. He had some pushback, but I think in all, as you'll hear, he's a very open-minded guy. Present him the data, and he's willing to consider it and factor it into his worldview. So I want you to hear what he has to say about that. But here's the fulcrum point. If mind equals brain has been falsified, if there is this extended consciousness realm, then we have to take seriously the possibility that people, when they claim they're experiencing other phenomena in this extended realm, we have to take seriously that that might be real, whether they're achieving that through LSD, or whether they're achieving that through a drum ceremony, or whether they're achieving that through some kind of religious or spiritual experience. That just seems to be a possibility in the way that human beings function. And I think that that's one of the real blocks that atheists have, is they're so married to this idea that that extended consciousness can't possibly exist, that they have to, in the same way that Christians do, they go through these kind of mind-numbing apologetics to kind of turn everything away from the obvious. The obvious is that when Constantine is going to sack Rome, this guy really is trying to connect with some spiritual wisdom to find out if he should go for war, because there really is something out there. We don't know what it is, but it does show up sometimes.
Well, I think that if someone excludes from their candidate list of possibilities the world of spirit, they, you know, are not fully rational. However, I would point out that when oligarchs claim to be in connection with gods or, you know, metaphysical forces, the citizen would do well to be skeptical. And I would just point out that historically, the problem has not been that the populations have been immune to the oligarch's claim of, you know, that he's connected to the metaphysics, to the world of spirit. It's been that they weren't suspicious that he was just using the world of the spirit as a false narrative to gain political power. And I would just point to the Vatican. In my mind, you know, it's a secret society. It knows well the truth about the religion and its origin, but it keeps that to itself because it enjoys the benefits of the power of the religion. So, you know, I would just say that you'd have to take it on a case by case basis. And I would, you know, stand with you as far as, yeah, you really should not exclude the world of the spirit. There have been things, you know, in my life that have been unexplainable and you know, have left a question mark. Exactly what is in back of all of this, I wouldn't be able to describe. But I would also say when someone, particularly those that are trying to gain political power, where it really is necessary to be skeptical is when someone is asking for political power on the basis of a narrative that either interacts with God or has some kind of claim about being connected to occulted wisdom. This, I think the first response should be, no, that's an extraordinary claim, and you've got to bring extraordinary evidence for us to believe it, because otherwise we're just going to think you're trying to gain control. So that would be my position on it.
And I totally agree. And I think history bears that out at every turn. So I, too, wouldn't claim to understand what that greater reality is or how it interacts with our political systems. But I agree with you. You got to be the first step is to be really cautious, because we've all seen that game played so many times. Now I'll tell you the position that I sit in there.
Yeah.
And tell me how you feel about that. Because I look again at your work and I say, wow, this is fantastic in that it causes us to do this shift. And this shift is to say, we need to look at the conspiratorial angle of Rome and, you know, people in power and what they'll do, the oligarchs, as you say. And then I look at the just overwhelming evidence that you have that there is this connection between the Roman approved version of history that Josephus writes matches what's in the Gospels of the New Testament. It's undeniable. The only conclusion we can draw from that is that those writers of the New Testament, whoever they were going off of this historical account. And from that, the conclusion that I come to, which is where I stop, is to say that Christianity, as it's currently understood and practiced still throughout tens and tens of thousands of churches and among millions of churchgoers who never even begin to understand these kind of complicated biblical scholarship stuff, there, I think they're just stopped right in their tracks by the obvious evidence that you present that tells them that the scriptures that they think are holy are not holy. They're from this historical account of this guy. But I kind of stop there. I don't have to go and take on the entire theory that it was completely orchestrated and someone was running the whole show with this grand plan. Again, I don't have to buy into that or not buy into that, because that's where your work takes me. Do you think I'm pulling up short there and missing the big picture, or is that within the realm of what you're saying? Because sometimes I've heard you say that, you know, in the last conversation we had, I thought you had an excellent point when we kind of came to the same point and you said, look, I can't create history that isn't there. I can only say, here's what we know, here are the facts, and then here's my theory on how it happened. I don't know if my theory is correct or not. I can just put together what we have, and what we have is pretty strong that the Bible's origins can be traced to Josephus.
Right. Well, the first thing is that it is a building block of intellectual structure, and you have to notice a lot of different things, and one can easily come to a position, and many people who read Caesar's Messiah do, that there is dependency, the ministry of Jesus, the adult ministry, is dependent upon. In other words, that it is not history, but rather for some reason literature that was developed out of this other story. Okay, so that's just sort of like what I think is completely obvious and can be demonstrated, you know, just by anyone who wants to read through Caesar's Messiah. You can just see it. Now, the question is it possible that that system of related events was put into the Gospels just because they needed some basis to come up with the story of Jesus Christ? And I would point out that you have to read the Gospels a little bit carefully to get to my point, but you have this character that Jesus looks forward to called the Son of Man. And this individual is really more powerful than Jesus in many ways, because Jesus refers to him as coming with great power, and he describes these amazing things he's going to do. Now, all of these events that Jesus predicts will associate with the visitation of what he refers to as the Son of Man are military victories of the Flavian Caesars. It's the crushing of the Galilean towns, the encircling of Jerusalem with the wall, the razing of the temple, the abomination of desolation. These things are military victories of the Flavians. And so, you know, it is a simple understanding that when Jesus predicts that someone who has a messianic title will come in the future and achieve the Flavian military victories, then the idea that these are were not put in there to establish the genre of typology that reveals the Messiah, I think would be, you know, to have been it, you know, something that was accidental, would be like, oh, just a one in a million thing. If you go to the beginning of the Gospels, if you go to the first pages with Matthew, you see the structure of typology that links Moses to Jesus. Because you, and I won't go into it because I've done it in a prior show, but you have a series of events that are taken from the life of Moses that are reused in Jesus's beginning of his ministry.
The Exodus, the killing of the firstborn. I mean, anyone who has a basic understanding of the Bible has to scratch their head and go, hey, haven't I heard this story before? Right.
Exactly. And so now the purpose of it is to establish the character Jesus as having this linkage to the divine prophet Moses. Now, therefore, when the same system of names, concepts, and locations occurring in sequence roll forward and link Jesus to Titus and to the Flavian Trinity of Caesars. Yes, it is possible that the point of the author was not to have the reader draw this connection, but that would beg the question as to why he established the character of the Son of Man who Jesus is predicting. Now, bear in mind the Flavian Caesars were very specific about claiming the title of the Jewish Messiah. To them, that was just a trophy that they won in war, essentially.
Let's back up, and if we can, I just want to cover some basic terms, because again, I don't know how exactly I'm going to use this, but one of the things I think that is frustrating for people is that to have a grasp on this, you have to dive deep. There's no way around it. But at the same time, you can't dive deep without losing a ton of people, and you wind up talking way over their head.
Yep.
A couple terms that I want to kind of nail down. One, what is a Flavian? And then two, and this I think is so central to what you bring forward, is who is Josephus? How does he become a Flavian? And then lastly, this is such a great point that you make, what is Josephus's stated belief about what the Jewish prophecies that he was raised in? He's a Cohen, you know, he's from a rabbinic family. So this is his born religion, his professed beliefs, but those beliefs change, and they change to say that the prophecies are really something different. So those three, you know.
Well, first, the Flavian family, they were a family of three Caesars. They are the basis of the Christian concept of the Trinity. You know, this bizarre just completely inappropriate theological structure that has somehow popped up into Christianity, which has had no basis in Judaism, but somehow has come to exist in the Gospels and does require an explanation, though both New Testament scholars and theologians seem to avoid the question. But the fact is that the Flavians were is a family of three Caesars, a father and two sons. The father and the eldest son, Vespasian and Titus, were the generals of the war against the Messianic movement. Nero brought them into Judea because they were the best generals that he had. They had spent decades in Gaul and Brittany, defeating the Druids. And so when the Jewish rebellion broke out in 66 and the Jews were able to destroy the Roman legion that was in control of the region and also set up a nation state. It was a crisis for the empire, and he brought in his best generals and told them to go down and restore Roman order. So the two Flavians did, and in the middle of the war, Nero died, and this set off the year of the four emperors, where you had political chaos in Rome, and it ended up that Vespasian basically took the throne from the Julio-Claudians. Now, this was an enormous shift because you'd had over 100 years of a particular family, or they weren't really a family, but they were related, and they were referred to as the Julio-Claudians. It includes all of the best-known Roman Caesars, Julius, Augustus, Nero. They were all Claudians. And so when Vespasian took the throne, it was a real departure because it was a brand new family. Titus stayed back in Jerusalem. He concluded the war against the Messianic movement. He defeated it. And then he returned to Rome. The Flavians then ruled until about the year 100, from, say, 69 through 100. Vespasian died after about 11 years. Then Titus was Caesar. He died after 2 years, and his brother Domitian concluded the Flavian reign, and he was basically assassinated. And this ended the Flavian reign. Now, they had, as a court historian, and they maintained a number of court historians. It wasn't just Josephus, but they had Flavius Josephus, who they had captured. According to Josephus's biography, he had an enormous background in Judaism. He had been a member of all three of the well-known sects, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes. He had been a priest, was a priest. He, for some reason, even though he had doubts about the war, he was given control over the rebel forces in Galilee. The Flavians captured him, at which point he had a divine moment and realized that the messianic prophecies that the Jews held were about a Jew, were in fact about the Flavians.
So this is like Elijah, and what other prophecies would he have held?
Well, basically the star prophecies and the prophecy that said that a root of Jesse and a branch of David will rule the world forever. And if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, you'll see that the Messiah was a concept of organizing their military against the Romans. Josephus wrote that what most propelled the Jews to rebel were their belief in the coming of Messiah. And it's very, you know, the Messiah is not precisely spelled out, but it's real easy to understand what a Messiah was in this context, because basically, you are claiming direct lineage from David. And so if you understand David's role in the history of Israel, then you can understand what a Messiah is. And basically, it's a warrior priest who will lead the army against invaders, defeat them, because this individual has the power of God. And so if you look in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you'll see that they are, you know, referring to a Messiah who would come and be a military leader. This, of course, is reiterated by Josephus, who says this is what actually most propelled the rebellion. So even though it isn't recorded per se within Roman history or in the Gospels, you can easily have a clear understanding of the history, is that, you know, you have the Messiah as a concept. The religious Jews do not accept Roman rule, particularly the parts which insist on worshiping images of the Caesar in their temples. This would violate the principle of no graven images. And so you have a rebellion, and it is a messianic rebellion. Now, what's really important to understand is that Josephus then took the position that the messianic prophecies were really not about a Jew, but about the Flavian dynasty.
And this is a monumental shift,
it's
right?
It is the new covenant. You see, because in the Gospels, you have the individual called the Son of Man who's going to come and achieve all of these things. So when Josephus morphs the Jewish messianic prophecies onto the Flavians, he is adopting the exact same theological principles and structures that are in the Gospels. This is Tacitus. The mysterious prophecy really referred to Vespasian and Titus. Suetonius wrote, this prediction referred to the emperor of Rome. Josephus wrote, the oracle denoted the dynasty government of Vespasian. Okay, there is your official position of the Flavian historians. The messianic prophecies foresaw the Flavian dynasty. The individual who comes and who works the events that Jesus predicts is clearly can be seen as Titus Flavius, because he actually does the events Jesus predicts. Now, what could be simpler, Alex? What could be easier than simply to see all this as unified literature? I mean, it's just the most natural, obvious way to read the literature. And that's that. It goes back to the point you were making earlier about, you know, sort of what level of understanding can someone come to when you look at the material I present, the evidence I present. Some people can say, well, you know, it shows dependency. Others go all the way and they say, oh, gee, the whole thing is just this complex typologic system to link the Son of Man to the Flavian Caesars. Now, I'll just go this far. The strongest interpretive framework to read the Gospels with, in other words, if you want to make sense of the Gospels, if you want to sit on page one and read to the end and kind of not have gaps in understanding, the simplest way to read it is just that it's written to predict the Flavian Caesars, that the Son of Man character Jesus is developing, and the prophecies that Jesus is making about him are simply coming from exactly the same literary perspective that Josephus, that Suetonius, and Tacitus had. That the authors of the gospel have this belief that the Son of Man is going to come and do these things. The only difference is that instead of using a name Vespasian or Titus, they actually use the title of Son of Man. But if they had written, if the authors of the gospel had simply written, Titus will come and raise the temple, and he will be the Son of Man. There's no question, there's no puzzle. It's just with that single word, the whole gospels make perfect sense.
But I wanted to pull you back up to another 10,000 foot level on a point that I think is critical and just can get lost in this whole discussion, because people are throwing so much, all the rotten tomatoes from so many different angles, that you just kind of want to throw up your hands and kind of forget it. But this is a point that I think is also lost in all this. When we talk about the gospel writers and we say that they were clearly influenced by Josephus, and we'll just leave it at that, whether it was the extent of that influence will maybe set aside for a second.
Or even the purpose.
The purpose.
Say that there is a dependency between the two bodies of literature.
Right. But here's the other point. The gospel writers are putting these words in the mouth of Jesus, and they're calling them prophecy. They are saying that Jesus came to the edge of Jerusalem and he prophesied about what was going to happen. So this is something else that I think gets lost sometimes when people want to say, well, we already knew that maybe the gospel writers were depending on Josephus or this and that. You go, hey, wait a minute. They weren't writing history. They were supposedly writing the most divine, inspired prophecy of this leader of the church who foresaw something happen. If those guys were using as their crypt notes an historical account, it kind of throws all bets off.
Well, what it does is it shows that the theories that have been developed from modern New Testament scholarship are way too complicated. And the much simpler, parsimonious explanation is that they're writing these prophecies about the Flavian military victories because it pleases the Flavians, that they are taking the perspective of the victor that Jesus is prophesizing that the Jews will be evil, that there will be demonic possession, and that they're going to get crushed, and that these specific events will occur that will show that they, in fact, have lost their covenant with God, and that there's going to be a new covenant.
Okay, let me jump in here one more time. Next, we talk at length about Robert Eisenman, a very well-known, respected biblical scholar who wrote a book, James, Brother of Jesus, which was quite controversial, but also very well established in solid scholarship, and that was that James, who was the brother of Jesus, but I know from talking to Christians when I talk about James, Jesus' brother who inherited Jesus' ministry, well, they have this puzzled look on their face, so I know a lot of Christians don't know this history, but it's all in your Bible if you want to read it. But what Eisenman did was clearly show that although we know very little historically about Jesus, we know quite a bit about James. And he makes the further natural conclusion that what we know about James and his ministry, we can assume to be true about Jesus and his ministry. And that leads us to the conclusion that Jesus was a rebel, a warrior, a fighter against the Romans, that he doesn't really fit into this model that's painted into the Gospels of this turn the other cheek, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's kind of thing. It just doesn't fit with James. Of course, that's Eisenman's work. If you want to hear about Joe and I talking about that, you can listen to the full audio for this. But for now, I just wanted to provide you that little background in terms of who we're talking about here when we talk about Robert Eisenman. Well, the other thing I think that Eisenman does bring to the table here, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on it, is he does do a pretty convincing job of tracing some of the early origins of this anti-Semitic thread that we read from the Bible. There's no getting around it. And I think it's always, you know, for the casual Christian that's picked up the Bible, it's always been a head scratcher, you know. Jesus is Jewish. Why are there kind of these obvious anti-Semitic kind of rants in there?
Yeah, Bob does a really good job with this.
And I think it ties into your work.
It does. Yeah, of course. The important thing is it shows perspective of authorship. In other words, what is the mindset of the individual who's writing these words? And when Bob shows that there is humor and that it is a Roman humor, a sarcasm, he really is revealing sort of the foundation of Caesar's Messiah. And, you know, Bob and I would not agree on everything because, again, it goes to the idea that once someone has put a theory into existence, they have the responsibility of defending it. And there are points where, you know, we would not agree theoretically. And so there would, you know, that would just be the end of that. But in terms of providing a platform to understand Caesar's Messiah, Eisenman's work is the very best. And I think he really took scholarship further than anyone else. In other words, he really found the truth that had been hidden and brought it out in a very, very clear way, in my opinion, and is to be congratulated for James, a brother of Jesus. It's a wonderful work.
Joe, are there any of the critics or criticisms of Caesar's Messiah out there that you do take seriously and maybe give pause and say, I need to kind of rethink that? Has anything kind of hit you with that kind of tone?
No. During the period when the event in London was going on, there was just a number of criticisms that came out. Richard Carrier came out with one. Joel Watts chimed in. Bart Erdman. Chris White, and frankly, I mean, I couldn't even.
Bob Price is always cited, but I never understood exactly where he was coming from in his criticism.
Right. Well, Price and I did a long debate, several hours long, and that kind of, I thought, clearly exposed, you know, Bob's criticism as being, you know, it wasn't particularly strong. I mean, Bob took the position that the parallels didn't exist. He just said, you know, you're just seeing the parallels and I don't see them. And my response was, well, if you don't see them, sorry, but that's irrelevant. I can show by random sampling of readers that most people will see them. And certainly I can demonstrate statistically that they have a greater than, they have a parallelism that is identifiable.
Well, don't those guys also, and Carrier does this too, they kind of vacillate back and forth, and Watt definitely does it, vacillate back and forth between going, oh, he's going crazy with all these parallels, and then going, oh, well, we always knew the parallels existed.
Exactly, I know. Because you see, so many of them are just self-evident, are their events that are actually known to history, like the, you know, the circling Jerusalem at the wall, the raising of the temple, the crushing the Galilean towns, the abomination of desolation. I mean, this is just the part and parcel of all New Testament scholarship. Everyone knows this. So those parallels, which are inside this long sequence of parallels, those are just meaningless, according to the critics. And then when I show other ones within the same system, ones that can be identified by, you know, any normal reader can see that this is, that there is parallelism, that this isn't some kind of random connection. Well, there's just, frankly, it gets to the point where Bob Price, when I started, you know, pointing this out, he just had to, you know, basically not attempt to go any further. And the next morning, he announced he'd never do a public debate again.
You're to be congratulated, obviously, and I'm a great admirer of your willingness to do just that, to stand on your work and to take on all comers. I can tell you, having done hundreds and hundreds of hours of this, it's rare. It's rare that people will just have that kind of openness and willingness to take on their critics in a direct way. And it doesn't surprise me at all that Richard Carrier refused to come on this show, initially engage with me, but then when we got into the nitty-gritty of it, pulled away. I've had that repeated by several prominent atheists. I've had that same scenario repeated many, many times by several prominent Christians, although I've had some good Christian scholars who've come on the show as well. So it's not always that way, but when they're asked tough questions, a lot of times they shrink.
Yeah, they don't want to be embarrassed, and they know that their theories are basically have areas of weakness, and so they're afraid that in a debate structure or public structure, they will lose some of their audience.
Because they have these adoring fans that will really won't know what to do when that facade, you know, crumbles.
Yep, that's right. And particularly when you look at how difficult it is to make a living. You see, if I made a living in this area, I probably would have a different perspective. But
right. But
I have a lot of sympathy for these guys. I mean, the New Testament scholars that are trying to eke out an existence when they can sell like 5,000 books in a year. I mean, it's just it's heartbreaking. And I, you know, I'm sorry.
The one part I can't really get my arms around is how we treat Judaism in all this.
Well, it was a racist, xenophobic literature that came from, as I see it, just the difficulties of maintaining an ethnic religion in a world where there was so much violence. If you go through the Hebrew Bible, it's just one military.
Yeah, but it's just crazy. I mean, it's not monotheistic as it's kind of portrayed to be. It's from the beginning, there's many gods. There's this idea of sacrificing animals and stuff. The precursor to that was human sacrifice. That's kind of been established. I mean, somehow in this process, Judaism is elevated to some kind of status it just doesn't deserve.
Right. The religion is very primitive. It's retained a canon that came from a period of time very early on, and it had and the problem, of course, in fact, one thing I really like about Caesar the Messiah is that Gentiles have a really positive understanding of, in many cases, of the Hebrew Bible because of the relationship that it has to the Gospels, and so they actually see that the Jews are the chosen people, The principles of the Hebrew Bible that have been expanded and then changed and have become the story of Jesus Christ are given a stature that is inappropriate, because in fact, if you look at the literature carefully, it's xenophobic, it's racist. It promotes violence. I mean, basically the...
I mean, there's a psycho... Its central character is this psychopathic, jealous god that just rains down horrible terror on people. I mean, that's a very primitive, religion that we wouldn't give, like you're saying.
I mean, the literature is pretty easy to understand. It's mind control. You have the Jewish oligarch. He wants his foot soldier to walk out and defend his territory. So he creates a story that God is on our side. Go out and do it. And then when they fail and get crushed, the remaining foot soldiers come back and the oligarch says, you know why we lost? Because you were wicked. You didn't live up to the purity rules or some other criteria that we've established that will connect us into God. And that therefore he didn't help us that time. So let us try to rededicate ourselves to this principle of God. Now you have to remember the oligarch is the priest. He is God's representative. So when he is making the case, remember I went back to earlier to the idea of when someone who is trying to obtain political power, you know, cites the metaphysical, you have to be suspicious. Well, unfortunately, the Israelite soldiers didn't use this principle.
Right.
They just bought into it time and time again that, well, I guess we were evil. We're going to have to rededicate. And then we're going to, you know, be able to defeat the Kittim.
And this isn't unique to the Judaism either. I mean, everyone's playing the same game, right?
Everyone plays the same game. This is the oligarch theme. You know, you want to have rule over a group of peasants or of, you know, shepherds. You've got to have a story that connects into God. This is what these people want. And so you create the story, but it, of course, enables the oligarch to retain power through his control over the priesthood. And so then, you have the literature, which I think, had it not been for the existence of Christianity, probably would have died out because it is so zany. I mean, the Hebrew Bible is just,
Exactly. If you look at it analytically,
it is so zany, it's hard to imagine it could have made it into the modern world. But because the Jews were so isolated because of anti-Semitism, and because the literature of the Hebrew Bible was so codified by its being incorporated into the New Testament,
exactly right.
Then you ended up with this absurd situation now, where the Hebrew Bible is trying to then use it as a template for existence in the 21st century. I mean, you know, the Abrahamic traditions have been the single greatest calamity that has ever befallen certainly Western civilization, but I would argue the world. I mean, it has...
Well, that's always a difficult argument to make because it's compared to what? But I get what you're saying.
It has been an absolute catastrophe. And if there's one thing that comes out of Caesar's Messiah that I hope occurs, is just that it will not only end the ability of the politicians to use Christianity as a propaganda tool, but eventually it will force people to then put some sunlight into the Hebrew Bible and say, wait a second, you know, what we're looking at tip to stern from Genesis all the way through the book of Revelation is the literature of oligarchs. These stories are there to fool people into giving power to people that want to rule.
Perfectly said. Start with the conspiracy and work outwards. Not everything is a conspiracy, but start there and you're on a good track. Joe, it's been absolutely great talking to you again.
Oh, it's always such a pleasure. Can't wait to do it again. And thank you so much for having me on your show. It really is just a lot of fun and really interesting and entertaining for me to talk with you, Alex.
Thanks again to Joseph Atwell for joining me today on Skeptico. As I said the last time we talked to Joe, and I'll say it again because it bears repeating, one of the things I really admire about Joe is his fierce independence. I mean, here is a guy who basically came up with this theory through his own research. He's had to buck the trend every step of the way with biblical scholars on both sides of the fence, both Christian and atheist, attacking him, and he withstands, I think, all that criticism. To me, what's most clear is that Joe has redefined the debate, and few times can you say more than that. So much of the biblical scholarship up to this point, the Christian apologetics, the dozens of best-selling books that get published, focus on issues like the resurrection of Jesus and the differences between one gospel and the other in terms of how they treat those. The letters of Paul, the parallels with the Dead Sea Scrolls,
all miss the point if we merely focus on Joseph Atwell's line of reasoning and ask whether there's reason to believe that the prophecies in the New Testament were derived from a Roman historian who had proclaimed that the Roman emperor was the new Messiah. We're then forced to look at the Bible, its authors, and those who promoted and used it as a vehicle for control, but we're forced to look at all those folks in a whole new light. So a question to tee up from this episode would be, what do you make of the Caesar's Messiah theory? Of course, the place to let me know your opinion and to just sound off in general about this show is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. From there, you can bounce over to the forum, leave a message through Facebook, or drop me an email. I do hope you enjoyed this episode. It was great fun putting it together. It was a lot of work, but it was the kind of stuff I love to do, and I learned so much in preparing for this and in executing it, and in the next show, which is really a follow-up to this because I've interviewed a critic of Joseph Atwell, a very vocal critic, and the interview didn't turn out to be quite the way that I thought, but those are interesting too. You'll have to hold on to listen to that. I do have to thank Ian for helping me prepare for this interview. So Ian, I hope you like the way that this came out, and we hope to see you on the forum to discuss it. And I hope the rest of you will join us in that discussion as well. So that will do it for today's episode. Do take care, and bye for now.